If our romantic partner is expected to be our only sexual partner, what happens when sexual compatibility isn't there? What do we do when one person is unwilling or unable to be sexual with the other? In cases like this, monogamy struggles. It seems, on the face of it, absurd to tell another person, "I forbid you to have your sexual needs met by anyone but me, and I won't meet your sexual needs." But that's precisely what happens. The person with unmet sexual needs faces a choice: pressuring, coercion, cheating on the sly, or celibacy. Even when a good monogamous relationship is non-sexual through mutual choice, it is often treated dismissively, if not derisively. You and your wife haven't had sex in 2 years. "Oh, I'm so sorry. That must be awful. What's wrong?" One of the advantages of polyamory is that it does not mean hitching all your sexual wagons to a single star. It allows room for change that would threaten the existence of many monogamous relationships. An emotionally satisfying, deeply committed, loving, open relationship between two people who are or have become sexually incompatible can flourish without being sexually thwarted for the rest of their lives. Now, of course, needs aren't necessarily transitive. What you need from one partner can't necessarily be given by someone else. We're not saying polyamory is an easy solution for mismatched or missing desire. For some people, sexuality is an expression of romance and love. Such people may need to be sexual with all their romantic partners. And if that sexual expression isn't available, it may damage the relationship. Many polyamorous people, including both of us, have deeply connected romantic relationships in which sexuality plays little or no role. We have also both spoken to people who self-identify as asexual, who find polyamory attractive because it allows them to form intimate, loving bonds without the fear that they are depriving their partners of the opportunity for a happy sex life. Here's Eve's story.
Peter and I had been together for over 10 years when we married. On our wedding day, we hadn't had sex in close to a year and a half. We started out like most couples do, horny as hell, experimenting and fucking like rabbits. And like many couples, our sex life declined over time, though our decline may have been quicker than many, due to stress, my poor body image, medications I was on, and several long separations due to my graduate program. It was, in fact, a need for more sexual variety, and more sex, that initially prompted our choice to explore first swinging and later polyamory. When I became lovers with Ray, my sex life with Peter improved dramatically for a while, then plummeted again. After he had been with Cleo and Gwen for about a year, we finally sat down and had the talk. I had realized that I no longer felt any sexual interest in Peter, and I hadn't for a long time. The guilt from not being able to give him the intimacy I thought he deserved, and his frustrations when I rebuffed his advances, were too much for me to carry. If we were to stay together, I needed a formal, mutual recognition that the sexual component of our relationship had ended. I realized, I told him, that he might not want to remain my partner, and I would accept his decision. The conversation hurt for both of us. Peter had to take some time to think my proposal over. Eventually, he came back to me and told me he still wanted to be my partner. The transition wasn't easy, but it was much easier than trying to maintain or revive a sexual relationship that wasn't working anymore, or for me to continue carrying the guilt of not providing what I thought Peter deserved. Ultimately, the conversation did not actually institute a new change. It made what was already happening transparent and consensual. It was after this agreement that we decided to get married.
To come to terms with their new agreement and forge a relationship that was loving, mutually supportive, and happy, Eve and Peter had to confront a number of deeply ingrained toxic beliefs about sex and relationships. You owe sex to someone you're in a relationship with. Sexual desire is something that can be offered or withheld at will. A lack of sexual desire is, at best, a sign of something wrong in the relationship. At worst, it's a sign of malice. Desire isn't a button you can push. No matter how much you may care for someone, no matter how much you may want to meet their needs, if sexual desire is not there, it's not there. Yes, some people can work on it, and many couples can work through reduced desire, but many can't, and there's nothing wrong with them. Sometimes you just don't want it, and sometimes you just don't want the person you're supposed to want. You should never have to have sex when you don't want to. We don't think it's something you should have to do to save a relationship, to show you care, or to get any of your other needs met, financial, emotional, or social. Not desiring someone physically isn't a sign that you don't love them, or that you want to hurt them, or that there's something wrong with you. It's not even a sign that you're not a compatible partner with them. It just means that, for whatever reason, your body isn't responding to them. And if you don't want it, for heaven's sake, don't do it. Many deeply loving, lifetime relationships eventually become platonic. When we went looking for statistics, we found that between 20 and 30% of relationships are sexless, with partners having sex less than 10 times per year. Around 5% of married men under 40 are completely celibate. By age 50, that increases to 20%, and that percentage keeps going up with age. We found statistics about sexless marriages in papers and books with titles that make it quite clear how such relationships are viewed. The decision to remain an involuntary celibate relationship. Rekindling desire, a tired woman's guide to passionate sex. Couple therapy and the treatment of sexual dysfunction. It's unfortunate that we pathologize something that is so normal and that we assume non-sexual relationships must be broken. Polyamory allows for the possibility that we can remain in relationships that matter to us and have sex when and only when we want to. Because we want to, and not because we have to, because we fear losing someone we care for. Eve and Peter have faced judgment and misunderstandings over their agreement, even from their closest friends. Peter is, by any objective measure, an absolutely wonderful human being, and Eve has more than once felt subtly shamed by mutual friends for denying him sexual access. She has been made to feel ungrateful or broken for not desiring him. She has even been told that their marriage isn't real. One well-meaning friend once commented, "It's so sweet that you still wear your wedding ring." If that's the case, then millions of married couples are not really married. The only thing unusual about Eve and Peter is that their situation was mutually agreed to, and they've chosen to talk about it openly. They want to share their story so that others in the same situation know there's nothing wrong with them. They are not alone, and their relationships are still legitimate and real. Defining partnership. What is a romantic partnership? What separates a non-sexual romantic relationship from an ordinary friendship? Can asexual people have romantic relationships? Don't laugh. That last one is a question Eve and Franklin have both heard. Wikipedia says that romantic relationships are characterized by emotions of love, intimacy, compassion, appreciation, and affinity. That definition is not very helpful, because many of us feel these same emotions, though perhaps to a different extent, for non-romantic friends. The idea that relationships are characterized by these emotions is a good starting point, but ultimately, we believe the definition of a romantic relationship is up to the people involved. Here is Franklin's story.
I had been in a relationship with my partner Amber for more than a decade. In the beginning, it looked pretty conventional. We lived together, shared a bed, sat down for dinner together at the end of the workday. A few years later, she moved to a different town to pursue a graduate degree in neurobiology. Our relationship went from live-in to long distance, but still kept many of the conventional markers of a romantic relationship. We visited often, sat down together when we could, and remained lovers. Less than a year after that, I moved even farther away. Amber and I continued a long-distance relationship, but it became harder and harder. She was working on her master's thesis in bioinformatics and minoring in pure mathematics, so more and more of her attention became focused on her academic work, and less space was available for maintaining any romantic relationship, much less a long-distance one. I became accustomed to seeing her less often, twice a month, then once a month, then every 6 weeks. Eventually, Amber came to me and said she didn't believe the sexual part of our relationship could continue. Her academic work was consuming her life, and her libido was feeling the effects of the stress. She said she was afraid that being open with me might be the end of our relationship, but she felt she needed to take sex off the table. I really enjoyed being Amber's lover, and what she told me stung, but in truth, it didn't hurt as much as I expected it to. I have always admired Amber, and I believe very strongly in the work she's doing. I also believe just as strongly that sexuality must be consensual, and I don't want to have a lover who does not have the space or desire to be enthusiastic about being with me. Most of our relationship changed surprisingly little. We still shared a bed when we visited each other, but just for snuggling and sleeping. We were, and are, still physically affectionate with one another. We still love each other greatly. When I moved to Portland, the relationship became very long distance indeed. It is still a romantic relationship, though. We still love one another, and we are still involved in one another's lives multidimensionally to the degree that we can be. We have exchanged rings. We still share intimacy. When she encountered turbulence in one of her other relationships, she was able to call on me for support, and I flew across the country to be with her. We share our hopes and dreams, joys and sorrows. We continue to be absolutely committed to each other's happiness. In all the ways that matter, Amber is still my partner. Our relationship does not look like conventional romantic relationships, at least not since the Victorian era. But one of the amazing things about polyamory is that we can chart our own course, defining our relationship to fit us rather than a cultural norm.
Franklin and Amber's experience shows that judging relationship success based on some arbitrary criteria makes less sense than judging success based on whether people involved think the relationship is a success. How many partners? It's possible to be single and poly. It's possible to only have one partner and be poly. If your intention is to remain open to the possibility of multiple romantic relationships, you are polyamorous regardless of your current relationship status. Indeed, if polyamory is a part of your identity, for some people it is, for others it isn't, you might be in a monogamous relationship and still be poly. Is there a right number of partners to have to be poly? No. Is there a right number for you to have? Maybe. There is certainly some maximum. There's a saying among poly people, love is infinite, time and attention are not. It's debatable whether love is infinite. In practical terms, it probably isn't. Time and attention definitely aren't. Different people have different constraints on the time and attention they can offer. And different relationships require different amounts. So some people can maintain more romantic relationship than others before they become, as the term goes, polysaturated. The number of partners you have room for can change. Some situations, such as starting a new job or caring for a baby or toddler, consume tremendous amounts of time and emotional space. It's normal to feel that you don't want to start a new relationship until more space opens up, though hopefully you will continue to nurture the ones you have. On the other hand, game changes happen. You may meet someone so amazing, so fantastic, that you're willing to rearrange parts of your life to create space for them. Game changes are disruptive, as we discuss in chapter 14. Cognitive scientists place a limit, determined by the size of our brains, on the number of individuals an animal is capable of having stable social relationships with. That is, remembering who each person is and how they connect to us and others. For humans, this number, called Dunbar's number, after a researcher who proposed this idea, seems to be somewhere around 150. Frankenpoly. Because different people have different needs, and polyamory allows us to distribute our need eggs into more than one relationship basket, it is possible to maintain a relationship in a poly setting that otherwise might not survive. We've talked about how happy poly relationships can exist between people with mismatched sex drives, or no sex at all. The same thing can happen when one partner is more sexually adventurous than another and wants to explore being tied up, spanked, or some other kink that leaves the other cold. Maybe one person really likes ballroom dancing, but the other has two left feet. Two of Franklin's partners love ballroom dancing, but he's never felt the bug. One person may have a deep religious conviction, not shared by the other. Polyamory offers an opportunity for different relationships to provide for different needs. The danger here is seeing other people as need fulfillment machines. When a need isn't being met, that need can feel bottomless, and it can be tempting to go out searching for a person to fill it. One of Franklin's partners calls this Frankenpoly, stitching together the perfect need-providing romantic partner out of bits and pieces of other people. We've also called it Pokemon Polly, after the idea that you need to collect a complete set of different kinds of partners. When we begin to look at people in terms of what needs they can meet, rather than whole people in their own right, we start down the road towards treating people as things. A person you're with only because you get some need filled when you insert time and attention tokens is not a full romantic partner joining you on the journey of life. Which is not to say that any attempt to have different needs met from different people leads this way. A friend of Franklin's has a need for specific sexual kinks that aren't met by her husband, and she has had success in seeking other lovers who share this need. But those other lovers are romantic partners in their own right, valued for reasons beyond helping meet that need. Some needs, though, don't lend themselves well to outsourcing. Needs for intimacy, for understanding, or for companionship are often attached to the people we are in a relationship with. If we have those needs met by Alice, we still may need those things from Bob too. Relationships that blossom. Because there is no standardized template for polyamory, it's rare to see two poly relationships that look the same. We have observed, however, that strong, successful relationships do tend to have some things in common. Returning to our garden metaphor. No two gardens look the same, but all gardens need certain things to thrive. Sunlight, air, soil, the right amount of water. What do poly relationships need to grow and thrive? Something we've both heard often is, when I started exploring polyamory, things I thought would be important and the things that turned out to be important were very different. We have found that poly relationships thrive most readily when they are free to change and adapt. When the people in the relationship are more important than the structure of the relationship. When they are free to advocate for their needs, to grow, even in unexpected ways. When they feel a sense of personal empowerment over their relationships. The relationships themselves tend to be strong, resilient, and happy. As we discuss in chapter 4 and 8, it can be tempting, especially if you are new to polyamory, to try to script what your relationships will look like. To decide in advance what kinds of people you will place into roles. People often do this to avoid dealing with issues like insecurity or fear of being left out. This approach treats people as interchangeable parts rather than as human beings with their own needs and desires. When we treat people as components to fit roles we have scripted for them, they are likely to feel disempowered, which plants the seeds for all kinds of trouble. What almost invariably does work is to remain open to relationships in a wide variety of configurations and develop tools for open communication, for advocating your needs, and for those acting ethically and compassionately, no matter what form relationships may take. As Eliza Yudkowsky says, you are personally responsible for becoming more ethical than the society you grew up in. Questions to ask yourself. A great tool for finding, growing, and maintaining good relationships is to think about the relationship you want from the perspective of the people you'd like to attract. The flip side is asking yourself questions about what you're offering them. Some questions that might help you are here. What are my needs in relationships? Are they attached to specific people? That is, do I need these things generally, or do I need them from just certain people? What configurations am I open to? Am I looking for a particular configuration because I'm afraid that others might be more scary or more threatening? Am I flexible in what I'm looking for? If my relationship changes, is that okay? Can I accommodate change, even unexpected change, or change I don't like? When I visualize the kind of relationship I want, how much space does it leave for new partners to shape the relationship to their needs? Am I focusing on an idealized fantasy more than on making organic connections with real people? What happens if I connect with someone in a way that differs from how I want my poly relationship to look? What message does that send to someone who doesn't fit neatly into my dreams? 3. Ethical polyamory. The first vital right is the right to love and be loved. Emma Goldman. We're not going to teach you the easy way to be poly. The tools we recommend will seem hard, because they are, at first. Like starting anything new, practicing polyamory comes with a steep learning curve and requires a lot of hard work. as you build new skills and challenge old ways of thinking. Our goal is to equip you with the tools you need to grow strong, loving relationships. Ethics are crucial to polyamorous relationships, and we believe it's worth developing an explicit ethical compass to guide us. That shouldn't be a controversial statement, but it is. Many people believe that ethics do not exist in any absolute sense, that they are all culturally determined. Even if that's the case, well then, with polyamory, we're building a new culture. What kind of culture do we want to build? Those are our ethics. The ethics of non-traditional relationships are such a huge topic that we can only touch on them here. But this entire book is about conducting polyamorous relationships ethically, so we must explain what we mean by that. Right and wrong poly. One of the things you'll hear a lot from poly people is that there's no right way to do poly. This is true. There are many ways to do poly, live polyamorously, that give you a decent chance of having joyful, fulfilling, meaningful relationships with low conflict. But when people say there's no one right way, it sometimes seems they mean there are no bad ways to do poly. We disagree. There are plenty of choices likely to lead you into pain, stress, drama, and tears. There are ways to do poly that shifts most of the emotional risk that comes with any intimate relationship onto one person. There are ways to do poly that reliably cause suffering. It seems pretty fair to say that approaches that are likely to cause pain to you and those you love probably aren't very good strategies. We are even comfortable calling such approaches bad ways of doing poly, though we are wary of the word wrong, which tends to make people unnecessarily defensive. After all, we're all ultimately trying to do the best we can. Choosing a flawed strategy doesn't make someone a bad person. The two of us have gone down some of those roads ourselves. We are all struggling to meet the same basic human needs. People make mistakes because they're trying to solve a problem, and many of the less successful approaches to poly tend to promise quick relief, but come with insidious hidden costs. All of us have done some very bad things. We've all hurt other people when we thought we were doing the right thing, or at least not a bad thing. We were probably trying to get our own needs met, blinded perhaps by those needs. The two of us are no exception. In fact, it is our many mistakes and what we've learned from them that qualifies us to write this book. So what does that mean to be ethically polyamorous, given that we're all going to make mistakes, hurt others, be buffeted by our emotions, and fall down sometimes? Being ethical means that you're willing to look at your actions and their effects on other people. If you're presented with evidence that you're causing harm, or that what you're doing won't achieve what you and your partners want, you will look for ways to change this. In making decisions, you will consider the well-being of everyone involved, and not just some. Being ethical also means that you're willing to have the kinds of discussions that would permit an honest analysis of the way you're choosing to do poly, without getting defensive or accusatory. Because after all, we're all learning. We are pioneers, and unless we're willing to assess the path we're on, and whether it's taking us where we want to go, we're likely to end up in some pretty messed up places. Evidence-based polyamory. We wrote the first draft of this book from a cabin deep in the temperate rainforest of the Pacific Northwest. On a half-hour walk from our front door, we passed a couple of dozen varieties of wild mushrooms. Some made delicious additions to our nightly dinners. Others would sicken or kill us. Luckily, we had a book telling us which was which, and what poisonous lookalikes are most easily mixed up with safe and tasty edibles. After identifying a mushroom in the book, we might make a spore print to be sure. And then wait, and we would take a little piece of the mushroom, sauté it, eat it, and wait a few hours, just to be sure that neither of us got an upset tummy or started seeing the garden gnomes. Oh God, so many garden gnomes, climbing up the walls. Only then would we cook up a nice big batch into mushroom pie. Obviously, because you're reading this book, this strategy worked for us. So let's imagine that we, as polyamorous people living in a mononormative society, are intrepid mushroom hunters discovering exotic, tasty treats by venturing into the forest. But here's the thing. We're new to this. Few are doing it. It's not part of our culture. There's no illustrated field guide, no cultural background to help us know what is poisonous and what's tasty, or what might give us hallucinogenic trips of our lives. So what do? We might look for other people. People already living off the land we're foraging on, say, and ask them what mushrooms they eat and which they avoid. We might watch what happens to others when they eat certain mushrooms. And if we can't find that kind of information, or maybe even if we could, we wouldn't wolf down a batch of some new mushroom all in one go. Probably we'd try a little piece, wait a while, then try a little more. And once we've determined that we can eat something with no ill effects, would we have a big dinner party and feed it to everyone else? If a dinner guest or two begins convulsing after consuming our delectable meal, would we shrug and say, well, it works for me, and continue to feed it to others? No. What we have just described is the process of collecting data. We like to do this as we explore new ways of relating to. We can observe, as we and others try out new relationship patterns, which choices tend to lead to pain and conflict, and which tend to lead to harmony. Eventually, gradually, these patterns become evidence of what actions are most likely to promote the well-being of everyone in a relationship network. These might not be right ways to do poly, like there are no right foods. We might call them good ways. Call this evidence-based polyamory, if you will. That's what we're striving to give you in this book. Everything we suggest to you comes from what we have observed to work most often. The things we recommend you avoid are things we have observed over and over to cause strife. We're not criticizing the people doing the bad things unless they act with malice. We're not holding up the people doing the things that work as perfect poly role models that would be a good idea to emulate, though sometimes maybe you should. All we're saying is, if you want to choose strategies to help you get where you want to go, these are the ones we've observed to be most successful in the long run. Polyamory is still new. We are not experts, because there are no experts. At times, we present questions that don't have answers yet. In joining us in this big experiment, you will be helping to forge a path that others can follow, contributing to the body of knowledge on polyamory that is taking shape. In this book, we lay our own experiences, and especially our mistakes, open to view, in hope that you can learn from them and avoid the same mistakes. We invite you to go out and explore the vast, fertile fields of new, undiscovered mistakes yet to be made, and then perhaps to share your experiences through your own blogs or comments on ours at morethan2.com, in poly forums, and with one another, so we can all keep learning. We use the term evidence cautiously. The formal study of multi-partner relationships is in its infancy, and genuine scientific evidence is sparse. Where we can back up our claims with peer-reviewed research, we will, but such instances will be rare. We look forward to a day when the state of knowledge has advanced to where it's possible to give genuinely evidence-based advice, but for now, it's more accurate to refer to the cases in this book as anecdote-based poly. A moral compass. Think of this book as a compass, not a map. There is no magic road to poly happiness. That said, as we emphasize over and over, the compass directions we've seen that lead to strong, vibrant, happy relationships are courage, communication, willingness to accept responsibility for your own emotions, respect for the autonomy of others, compassion, and empathy. For each person, the right way to do poly is to talk about your needs, fears, and insecurities, to talk about the ways your partner can support you, and to honor your commitments without being controlling or placing rules on other people to protect you from your own emotional triggers. Above all else, trust that you don't have to control your partner, because your partner, given the freedom to do anything, will want to cherish and support you, and always, always move in the direction of the greatest courage, toward the best possible version of yourself. Strong, ethical polyamorous relationships are not a destination, they are a journey. Nurturing such relationships is like walking toward a point on the horizon. You move toward it or away from it with each choice you make, but you never actually arrive. Sometimes you'll make a choice that takes you farther away, but that's okay, because you can always make another choice and start moving again in the direction you want to go. Before we can talk about things like nurturing healthy relationships and maximizing well-being, we need to make some assumptions about the kinds of relationships you want. What we mean when we use the word healthy. We know that poly people are a diverse bunch, and we can't speak to the full range of backgrounds, choices, needs, and expectations of our readers. Even so, we think that if we don't make the following assumptions, our advice would be pretty much rubbish. We assume that you seek like most people, to engage in relationships because you value love, connection, and belonging. Want your partners to engage in a relationship, and specifically a polyamorous relationship, of their own free will. Want your partners to feel loved, cared for, and secure in their relationships with you, and want to feel loved, cared for, and secure in your relationships with them. Value honesty in your relationships, which we define as, at minimum, everyone involved with you being aware of the other people you're involved with. Accept that all long-term relationships will contain some conflict, but do not want conflict, anxiety or pain to be the norm, and certainly not more frequent than joy, connection, or comfort. Some polyamorous people engage in a structure called don't ask, don't tell, in which the people involved don't talk about their other relationships, or even mention they exist. This approach often causes problems, as we discuss in chapter 10, 14, and 18. Accepting and honoring these assumptions will lead in a natural way to caring, supportive, open relationships. When we talk about good ways to do poly, we're talking about strategies that, in our own experience, seem most often to lead people toward these kinds of relationships. When we talk about healthy relationships, we are talking about relationships that move toward these values more often than they move away from them. On the subject of rights. We've talked about the idea of right as opposed to wrong, but what about rights? Rights are a cornerstone of many systems of ethics, including ours. In fact, we believe that choices that maximize well-being are not ethical if they infringe on another person's rights. For example, a decision that involves the well-being of a group of people by violating the consent of one. Say, telling a woman that she must bear a child that she doesn't want, but the rest of her family does, is unethical, because bodily autonomy is a right whose defense supersedes group well-being. It's common to hear the word rights used when the speaker actually means things I really want. In relationships, a right often means something I expect or something I feel entitled to, such as, I'm the wife, therefore I have a right to end your other relationships if they make me uncomfortable, or she and I have children together, so I have the right to decide who she can become involved with. We have the right to want what we want. We do not, however, have the right to get what we want. For rights, a higher bar needs to be set. So what is a right? Many people believe in the idea of natural rights, so-called inalienable rights that we're all born with, such as life, liberty, and so on. Often people believe that such rights come from things like human nature or the edicts of a deity. That's one morass we're not going to wade into, at least not in this book. Instead, we will discuss rights that are more like legal rights, rights a person has by law or custom. Often, they must be fought for before they are granted, as with all of the rights enshrined in modern constitutional democracies, for example. In proposing rights for relationships, we claim no natural authority for them. And we do not claim them as inalienable. Rather, we propose them as rights we think are essential to uphold if we are to build relationships based on the values we discussed. Such rights underpin ethical relationships. We suggest that these rights should be taken as a given for ethical polyamorous relationships, that individuals should embrace and defend them for themselves, and that polyamorous communities should uphold them. The rights we talk about here derive from two axioms, which together are a lens through which any relationship choice should be viewed. These principles are: the people in a relationship are more important than the relationship. Don't treat people as things. These are simple, but not necessarily easy. We will be returning to them often. Axiom 1, of course, does not mean that relationships aren't important, and it doesn't mean that you should never make personal sacrifices for the benefit of a relationship. But while it is often necessary to make sacrifices of time, short-term gratification, or non-essential desires for the long-term benefit of a relationship or a partner, it is never desirable to sacrifice yourself for a relationship. We discuss this further in chapters 4 and 5. And while individual wishes do sometimes need to be subsumed to collective well-being, it's important to remember that relationships exist to serve the people in them. If a relationship stops serving the people in it, it's not doing its job. It may not even have the reason to exist anymore. Thus, axiom 1 is, like axiom 2, always true. That's why it's an axiom. Even though the people and the relationship need to serve each other, the people are always more important. Always. In practice, these axioms mean that relationships are consensual, and people are not need-fulfillment machines. People cannot and should not be obligated to remain in any relationship. If a relationship ceases to meet the needs of the people in it, that relationship can end. People are not commodities. Ethical relationships recognize the humanity, needs, and desires of each individual involved. A relationship bill of rights. In 2003, Franklin posted a secondary's bill of rights on his growing polyamory website. It rapidly became the most popular and most controversial page on the site. Many people at the time objected to the idea that secondary partners should have rights at all. Here, we expand on the secondary's bill of rights to a relationship bill of rights. To develop this list, we examined other documents that defined rights, from United Nations documents to rules from domestic abuse organizations. We think a pretty high bar needs to be met before something can be called a right. Here's what passed the test. You have the right, without shame, blame, or guilt, in all intimate relationships, to be free from coercion, violence, and intimidation, to choose the level of involvement and intimacy you want, to revoke consent to any form of intimacy at any time, to be told the truth, to say no to requests, to hold and express differing points of view, to feel all your emotions, to feel and communicate your emotions and needs, to set boundaries concerning your privacy needs, to set clear limits on the obligations you will make, to seek balance between what you give to the relationship and what is given back to you, to know that your partner will work with you to resolve problems that arise, to choose whether you want a monogamous or a polyamorous relationship, to grow and change, to make mistakes, to end a relationship. In poly relationships, to decide how many partners you want, to choose your own partners, to have an equal say with each of your partners in deciding the form your relationship with that partner will take, to choose the level of time and investment you will offer each partner, to understand clearly any rules that will apply to your relationship before entering into it, to discuss with your partners decisions that affect you, to have time alone with each of your partners, to enjoy passion and special moments with each of your partners. In a poly network, to choose the level of involvement and intimacy you want with your partner's other partners, to be treated courteously, to seek compromise, to have relationships with people, not relationships, to have plans made with your partner be respected, for instance, not changed at the last minute for trivial reasons, to be treated as a peer of every other person, not as a subordinate, even when differing levels of commitment or responsibility exist. Consent, honesty, and agency. This relationship bill of rights contains three important intertwined ideas that need a bit of elaboration because they are fundamental to the kind of ethical polyamory we are espousing. Consent, honesty, and agency. Consent is about you, your body, your mind, and your choices. Your consent is required to access what is yours. The people around you have agency. They do not need your consent to act because you do not own their bodies, minds, or choices. But if their behavior crosses into your personal space, then they need your consent. Most of us will, over the course of our lives, encounter situations, perhaps at work, in our families of origin, or on the streets, where we have to put up emotional walls and accept a loss of control over our lives, our minds, or even our bodies. But we should never have to do that in our loving relationships. This may seem obvious, but make no mistake, it's a radical idea. Honesty is an indispensable part of consent. Being able to share, to the best of your ability, who you are in a relationship is critical for that relationship to be consensual. You must give your partner the opportunity to make an informed decision to be in a relationship with you. If you lie or withhold critical information, you remove your partner's ability to consent to be in the relationship. If a partner of yours has sex with a dozen casual hookups, he may be breaking an agreement, but he has not yet violated your consent. If he then has sex with you or engages in forms of intimacy, including emotional intimacy, without telling you about his actions, he has violated your consent because he has deprived you of the ability to make an informed choice. It's especially important to communicate things that might be deal-breakers or might be threatening to your partner's emotional or physical health. Your partner deserves to have a choice about how they want to participate in a relationship with you, given the new information. Examples might be sexual activity with others, drug use, acquisition or use of weapons, and violent impulses or behavior. Anything you know or suspect might be a deal breaker should be disclosed. You cannot force someone to make the choice you want them to make. And if you lie or withhold information, you deny them the ability to know there was a choice to be made. When people talk about dishonesty, often it's in the context of uttering falsehoods. By the simplest definition, a lie is a statement that is factually untrue. But there are other kinds of lies. For example, Franklin has spoken to a married woman cheating on her husband who said, "I'm not lying to him because I'm not telling him that I'm being faithful." In truth, she was lying. She was concealing information that, if he knew about it, would have changed his assessment of the relationship. When we talk about honesty in this book, we will do so from the position that a lie of omission is still a lie. Sometimes, when confronted with the notion of a lie of omission, people say, "Not mentioning something isn't a lie. I don't tell my partner every time I use the bathroom, and that's not lying." That brings us to the idea of relevance. An omission is a lie when it's calculated to conceal information that, if it were known to the other party, would be materially relevant to her. Failing to tell your partner how long it took you to brush your teeth isn't a lie of omission. Failing to tell your partner you're having sex with the pool man is. Agency is also intertwined with consent. Many people have been taught that if we are empowered to make our own choices, to have agency, we will become monsters. So we must surrender some of our decision-making power to external authority, which is somehow magically proof against becoming monstrous. This idea permeates society, but also seems to inform how we build our own intimate relationships. Without engaging in a debate about whether people are fundamentally good or bad, or option C, we ask you to look at your partners and ask yourself if you respect their ability to choose, even if a choice hurts you, even if it's not what you would choose, because we cannot consent if we do not have a choice. Empowering people to make their own choices is actually the best way to have our own needs met. People who feel disempowered can become dangerous. Communicating our needs and equipping others to meet them succeeds more often than attempting to restrict or coerce another into meeting them. We talk more in chapter 13 about what we mean by empowerment. When it's hard to act ethically. Embracing polyamory may well expose you to a great deal more uncertainty and change than people in monogamous relationships experience. Every new relationship is a potential game changer. Every new relationship might change your life. And that's a good thing, right? Picture your best relationships. Can you think of any truly awesome relationship that didn't change your life in some important way? The first time you had a long-term partner, did it change things for you? The first time you fell in love and had that love reciprocated, did it change things for you? Every person you become involved with stands a good chance of changing your life in a big or small way. If that weren't the case, well, what would be the point? The same goes for your partners and the new people they become involved with. And when their lives change, so will yours. Change is scary for a lot of people. And so preparing for poly relationships in many ways is about assessing and improving your ability to handle change. Even just thinking about it, taking a deep breath and saying, "Yeah, I know my life is about to change," is a huge step toward preparing yourself to live polyamorously. In some cases, for some people, circumstances may make change even harder than usual. For example, if you've just had another big change, a new job, say, or a big move, or a marriage or divorce, or a new baby, additional changes might cause you a lot more stress than they otherwise would. In these situations, it's common for people to look at polyamory and how it could change their lives, and then try to limit the amount of change that can happen. In our experience, this tactic doesn't work very well, and has a host of negative consequences, which we will discuss in chapters 10 and 11. A very common example is couples with young children. One real example we know of involved a couple with two very small children, one just a few months old. The mom was under intense stress, as often happens in such situations, and was emotionally volatile. As a result, the couple had a lot of restrictions in place to control each other's relationships. These restrictions were causing a lot of pain for the father's girlfriend, who was deeply in love with him but found her relationship with him unable to grow, while she was obliged to perform services such as babysitting for the couple in order to continue to have access to him. In situations like this, it's easy to fall back on the idea of putting the children first. Clearly, parents need to be able to live their lives in a way that allows them to care for their children's needs and provide loving, stable homes. More on this later. But too often, this need is used as an all-purpose shield to deflect any analysis of how a couple's behavior might be affecting other partners, or how it might be damaging their other relationships. Anything that looks like criticism can be framed as attacking a couple's right to care for their children. Make no mistake, kids change things. They did not choose to come into this world or choose the people who care for and make decisions for them. Only slowly and painfully, over many years, are children nurtured into agency and personal capability, with ability to think and plan, to learn and make rational choices, to develop judgment and individual responsibilities, and to consent or withhold consent. When children come into a home, for the first time, there are truly immature people present, making childish and selfish demands that have real moral legitimacy and must be dealt with. You have a choice how to deal with these issues, but you can't ignore them. Children add a categorical different new dynamic to the mix and, especially when they're very young, significantly subtract time and attention from adult matters. But that still doesn't mean you can use their needs as an emotional blackmail or to excuse unethical behavior in the adults around them. Being an ethical person means being ethical to everyone, partners and children. Children are not an ethical get-out-of-jail-free card. It's possible to be both a responsible parent and an ethical partner. We discuss ethical approaches to polyamory with children, with real-life polyparenting stories in Chapter 13, 15, 17, and 24. Remember that not every time in your life will be a good time to add new partners. If you have young children and you simply can't stand the idea of your partner having other partners without, say, instituting a hierarchy, you might wait until your children are a little older before you start new relationships. If you, or a partner, are struggling with anxiety, insecurity, depression, or other issues that leave you or them sobbing under the covers when the partner is with someone else, you could get into therapy and learn some coping strategies, or avoid polyamory altogether instead of bringing someone into your life but surrounding them with a metaphorical barbed wire fence to keep them from getting too close. If you are dealing with a recent betrayal, you might want to work with your partners on building trust before testing that trust by investing in someone new. If a particular relationship decision, such as placing a partner under a veto, is unethical, don't make excuses for it by saying, "But I have to because..." Try reframing the situation. Instead of looking for partners who will let you treat them unethically, who will let you compromise their agency or keep them at arm's length, ask yourself if you are in a position to seek new partners at all. Put another way, it is not ethical to hurt one person to protect another. It's better to look at yourself and the relationship you have and ask what you need to do, individually and collectively, to enable you to have relationships that will let you treat everyone well. Making ethical choices. Ethical decision-making is not always easy. That's fitting, because the measure of a person's ethics lies in what she does when things are difficult. We believe every decision that affects other people should be examined from an ethical perspective. Ethical relationships are something we do, not something we have. Being an ethical person means looking at the consequences of our choices on others. To make ethical choices and treat others with compassion, you need to have a strong internal foundation. Building this foundation is the subject of the next chapter, which begins Part 2, A Poly Toolkit. Questions to ask yourself. Here are some questions we can ask when making decisions that affect other people to help guide us towards ethical relationships. Have I disclosed all relevant information to everyone affected by my decision? Have I sought input from everyone affected? Have I obtained their consent where my decision overlaps their personal boundaries? Does my decision impose obligations or expectations on others without their input or consent? Am I seeking to have my needs met at the expense of the well-being of others? Am I imposing consequences that will make others feel unsafe saying no to me? Am I offering others the same consideration that I expect from them? Part 2. A Poly Toolkit. 4. Tending yourself. To be a good person, you always have to want to be better than yourself right now. P.Z. Myers. Polyamory is awesome. But as you listen to this book, you might wonder why anyone would walk down this road. We're asking a lot of you, dear reader. We tell you what can go wrong and illustrate our lessons with messy examples from our own lives. So you might be tempted to throw your hands up and say, polyamory sounds hard. But polyamory is awesome. By opening ourselves to multiple romantic connections, the two of us have built amazing lives filled with love and brilliance. Every person we have invited into our lives has made them better. Despite all the hard parts, neither of us would consider, even for half a second, going to a life of monogamy. We are nourished by the people who love and cherish us. Every partner we have had, all the relationships we have built, have made us stronger, taught us, supported us, made us better human beings. We keep hearing that polyamory is hard work. We don't agree. At least, not for the reason that people say. But developing the skills to be successful in poly relationships, that's a different story. Learning to understand and express your needs, learning to take responsibility for your emotions, that's hard work. Once you've developed those skills, poly relationships aren't hard. The skills we're talking about aren't all unique to polyamory. They'll benefit any relationship. But poly will be really, really challenging without them. These skills have been learned. And alas, they aren't often taught. Think of it like tilling the ground before planting a garden, so that things will more easily grow. You're learning a way of approaching relationships that helps them run smoothly. What skills are we talking about? Communication, jealousy management, being honest, compassionate, understanding. These are not easy to master. Relationship skills are emergent phenomena. They come from developing ways of thinking about relationships and about yourself. Once you've developed those ways of thinking, practicing these skills in your relationships starts to feel natural. If you get a handle on communication, compassion, and self-awareness, if honesty and jealousy management become a part of your approach to life, then managing multiple romantic relationships becomes easy. These attitudes and skills will express themselves outside of your relationships too. For instance, jealousy is the bugaboo we hear people mention most often. It is beaten most effectively by developing a strong sense of self-confidence and by confronting your personal demons of insecurity. Determine for yourself what you actually want and need from a relationship and learn the communication tools to ask for those things. Construct a sense of what is and what is not acceptable to you. All of these skills strengthen you in other ways as well. They're life skills. And they'll help when you're looking for a new job, or negotiating a raise, or buying a car. The same is true for things like communication and honesty in a relationship. Develop the habits of being open and honest with the people around you, and you'll likely find that communicating with a lover does not take work. It's automatic. Develop the habit of behaving with integrity, and all of your life will become simpler and smoother. Developing these traits is work, sure. But it's not relationship work. It's work you do on yourself. It benefits you in ways beyond your relationship. In fact, this is work that's beneficial to do, even if you have no relationships at all. We discuss some big concepts in this chapter and the next. Things like integrity, courage, worthiness, compassion. Don't get scared off. These are not states you need to attain. There's no magic bar you need to cross before you'll be good enough to be poly. These principles are meant as guides, as stars to navigate by. They are not innate character traits, but practices you can cultivate, skills you can learn. Of course, two chapters in one book can barely scratch the surface of the self-work that's involved in learning to practice ethical polyamory. What we're presenting is not a set of instructions, but a collection of principles that we believe are most important in building robust, ethical, open relationships. These principles are only a jumping-off point. You will need additional resources, books that we consider must-reads for anyone who still has work to do on building a strong sense of self. Setting Good Boundaries and Creating Healthy Intimate Relationships are those by Harriet Lerner and Bren Brown, listed in the resources section of the paperback and digital versions of this book, particularly The Dance of Intimacy and The Gifts of Imperfection. And if the things we discuss are linked for you to genuine mental health issues, such as serious anxiety, depression, or low self-worth, always consider professional help to work through those issues. We make this recommendation as people who have spent time in a therapist's office and have seen the transformative power of really good psychological help. Some problems can't be solved with self-help books. When you confront one of them, we urge you to get the help you need without shame or self-judgment. See chapter 25 for information on finding a poly-friendly mental health professional. Nosi te ipsum. Know thyself. You can't have what you want if you don't know what you want. You can't build a relationship that's satisfying without first understanding yourself and your needs, a willingness to question yourself, to challenge yourself, and to explore without fear the hidden parts of you are the best tools to gain that self-knowledge. A quote often attributed to Francis Bacon reads, "Your true self can be known only by systematic experimentation and controlled only by being known." Understanding and programming your own mind is your responsibility. If you fail to do this, the world will program it for you, and you'll end up in the relationship other people think you should have, and not the relationship you want. Polypreparedness starts with taking responsibility for the work you need to do. It's not easy. We are very good at hiding the truth about ourselves from ourselves. Some of us are very good at making everything seem like someone else's problem. Others of us are too good at taking on other people's problems as our own. No one's self-awareness is perfect, but it starts with the simple act of looking inward, of asking yourself, is this my problem? What is the issue? Self-awareness starts with awareness, period. One of our readers recently said, "You can come with baggage, but you're responsible for knowing what's in the suitcase." This is often described as owning your own shit. So what do you need to know? First, your needs. Most of us are never taught how to figure out what we need, let alone communicate it effectively. We are usually really good at feeling our feelings, but we tend to react to feeling rather than the actual need. For example, we tend to think that when we feel angry, it's because someone else did something bad to us, so we react to that person, tell them how much they hurt us, and perhaps demand they stop. Sometimes anger really is about the thing you think it's about. But often, particularly in intimate relationships, the anger is about something else. It's about a need that's not being acknowledged or expressed or even known. Getting in touch with those needs can be really hard. So working to understand the needs driving strong emotions is a valuable practice. Then there's understanding your needs as they pertain to relationships. Do you need to be polyamorous? Do you need to be monogamous? Do you need at least the possibility of eventually moving in with a partner? Or are you entirely closed to living together? Is sex an indispensable part of an intimate relationship for you? Are you open to non-sexual intimate connections? Are you willing to be involved in hierarchical relationships where you are a secondary partner or subject to a veto? Or do you need to have a larger hand in the course your relationship takes? You may find it helps to reframe some of what you're calling needs as things that feed you, things that give you joy. There's a dangerous side to focusing on needs, though, which we will discuss more later. This is the risk of treating people as need fulfillment machines. For example, it's not uncommon to see people create detailed descriptions of what their future partners will have to look like, be like, and want, what role they should play. That's dangerous. One way to think about and seek the kind of relationships you want without objectifying others is to think about what you have to offer or not. Examples might be, I can offer life partnering relationships. I can offer intimate relationships that don't include sex. I'm interested in supporting a family. I'm interested in caring for a family. I am not willing to move from my home for a partner. I have only 2 nights a week available for relationships, and so on. This exercise can be useful in setting boundaries and helping clarify the kind of relationships you're looking for and can sustain. It also plays an important role in partner selection, something we'll talk about later. It's not going to be very satisfying, for example, for you to end up in a closed triad if what you really need is an open network with the potential to date other people. If you are looking for life partners, you may choose to be long-term friends rather than romantic partners with people who are looking for other types of relationships. Minding the gap. Lots of polyamorous people we know, ourselves included, tend to be idealists. We have lofty goals for our relationships and how we want to conduct ourselves within them. But becoming the kind of person who can live those ideals is a never-ending process. Not only doing the work is important, understanding where you are right now is just as important. That includes understanding whether you are ready to share a partner or to be shared. The problem with being idealist about polyamory is that we risk putting ourselves into situations we're not ready for. If we do that, we risk hurting other people. Although self-awareness is important, so is self-compassion. We don't look inward so that we can pass judgment on all our flaws. We do it so we can be aware of how our behavior is aligning with our values, what effect we're having on other people, how we can stop sabotaging ourselves and our relationships. Understand where you are, yes, but also understand that it's okay to be there, at least for now. In the book Daring Greatly, Shane researcher Brené Brown introduces the idea of minding the gap. She's talking about the values gap, the space between who we are now and who we want to be. Minding the gap is part of walking toward the horizon we talked about in the previous chapter. There will always be times when we are imperfect, when we fall short of the best possible versions of ourselves. Minding the gap is being aware of where we are now and striving to move in the direction we want to go. That's part of living with integrity. Here is Eve's story.
When my husband, Peter, and I opened up for monogamy, the first few months of my relationship with Ray were difficult for Peter and for his relationship with me. He did a lot of work in those months to reach a place where he could come to terms with the connection between me and Ray, which flourished quite quickly, and give it space to grow. When, about 6 months into that relationship, Peter started what would become a 4-year long-distance relationship with Cleo, I wanted to show him the same grace he had shown me, all at once. He'd done all that work, I reasoned. I wanted to show him I could do the same. But I neglected to give myself the time and space he had taken. I wanted to start out at the same place it had taken him 6 months to reach.